As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey everybody, this is Taylor with a quick word of warning up front. It seems like about 30 seconds into the show, I think something bumped my mixing board and the audio increased, so there are times in this episode where I'm going to sound a little distorted, a little bit louder than normal. Just wanted you to know that we are aware that that was an issue. It will not happen again. It shouldn't impact your listening enjoyment too much. If it does, I apologize. But again, it just sounds a little bit distorted here and there. Just wanted to make people aware of it so that we didn't get a bunch of tweets about it. But with that said, I hope you enjoy today's episode with myself and Mr. Ryan Bailey. Everybody, and welcome to the Total Soccer Show. It is Monday, and this is sort of a weekend review. It's an international review, and to help me talk about all the games that have happened this weekend is Mr. Ryan Bailey. Hello, Ryan Bailey.
Hello, Tate. You know what? In this life, we only get 52 weekends in a year, and gosh darn it, I love those international break weekends. Aren't they the best? Aren't they wonderful? Yes, yes, yes. Fun.
I do not always enjoy the first international break of the season, nor the second one. This was our first one, though it occurred in November. But this time around, I found that even weirder because of COVID, because of the closed stadiums, because of the questions of, like, does this really need to be happening? I think some games did more so than others. Was this an odd break for you, Ryan?
Yes, I think the oddness of this break was definitely more pronounced, definitely from the empty stadium aspect. You looked at, say, Ukraine-Germany, mm-hmm. where they had 20,000 fans in there, and I think like 20,000 Vuvuzelas as well, which was quite frustrating from a viewer perspective. Or some kind of, maybe they were blowing, like, you know when you get tissue paper and put it on a comb and just blow it? Maybe they were all doing that. They were doing something annoying. So we should definitely ban fans from all stadiums once again. No, in seriousness, like that was that was fairly comforting hearing fans in that stadium again. But then, like La Bombonera, where Argentina played Ecuador on Friday, that I think is the strangest stadium I've seen yet without fans. To see that stadium, which is usually, you know, shaking from side to side with no one in it, it just felt very odd, and it all felt very training gamey, didn't it?
It did. I know what you mean, both in terms of the quiet being slightly odd, but then also, I guess I never realized how many stadiums are built for, like, obviously for fans to be in them, but to look right only when fans are in them. And to your point about La Bombonera, there are just, like, walls and divisions that exist there in order to keep fans apart and to have, like, allow for standing, but allow for people not to get crushed. And when you don't have people there, it just looks weird. It looks like weird walls and lines that don't necessarily need to be there, but obviously are, because when you have fans, they're necessary. So some of that architecture, I think, I also wasn't quite aware of until you don't have fans there to cover it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think some nations maybe were slightly aware of that. Spain, I think, for example, they didn't play in a big stadium. Mm-hmm. They didn't play in Bernabeu or the Nou Camp. And it kind of looked a bit like Real Madrid using their training ground for league games. It was a bit more suitable. But I think the greater issue here, as much as we can talk about the weirdness of having no fans, which we should be pretty used to by this point, the whole weirdness thing for me, Taylor, is actually why this international break is taking place. I mean, a lot of, say, like the Australasian World Cup qualifiers were postponed. They didn't have a break this time. Australia didn't play, for example. why and you know, why did we have the South American World Cup qualifiers starting in this break? What did it need to happen at this point when we're in October 2020 for a late 2022 World Cup tournament? And the Nations League as well, Taylor. I mean, I've come around to it from initial skepticism. But in this international break, it just, I don't know how appropriate it is to have all these international players being ferried all around the continent and even further afield for other kinds of games during a pandemic. It just seems like it's asking for trouble a little bit, doesn't it?
It does. I think this goes back to a point, like I think Daryl and I stressed when stuff started to reopen, when games started to begin again, is that we're going to have some flexibility. We're going to have to be okay with things not being ideal, because I don't think we're ever going to get back to that ideal in the short term. So we're going to have weird schedules and fixture congestion and things of that nature. I am still with you, though, that with that in mind, this seemed like an odd weekend because you had the Nations League game, but then you had some federations choosing not to play, as you said. My assumption with Common Bowl would be that the way they have things scheduled and with so many players spread around the world, as they so often are when it comes to Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, whomever else. So I'm guessing that's part of it, is that they've got to try to fit these things in. They've got the schedule. They know what they need to get done in order for World Cup qualifying to be complete on time. They do have the cushion of it being in the fall instead of the summer, so there's that. But I think even as things stand, we're still going to get like the intercontinental playoff, I believe is the title. We're going to get that like after the World Cup draw already. So I'm assuming that's why you can't move things around as much. It was still just a weird thing. Like things can be two things. It can be odd and required at the same time. But yes, especially I think you pointed out like in Brazil where you have what, over 2 million people. Or 5 million cases, 150,000 plus deaths, to have Brazil playing in Brazil, sending players back to an area that is not yet like really dealing with the virus properly. Pot calling the kettle black, being from the United States, but I'm quarantining. I'll say that much. So I think it was that also probably made it a little bit stranger that some of these games were being played in some of the locations they were.
Yeah, I think for me this is an opportunity to bring in something a little different, and something which I've actually touted before in written form, should you wish to go and find it, is to make, say, World Cup qualification, for example, a tournament in its own right, and make it, stage it in the odd year before the World Cup. So summer 2021, make it all, obviously it's impractical with the Euros in this instance, but there's a case for condensing all the qualifiers together into a short tournament style period, I think, and this might have been a good time to execute that. You could have even done it in the summer of 2022, couldn't you, for this tournament?
For example, you could. Then you run into the issue of if you're going to have the Euros in the off year, like how do you make things work? It's more to the point, I guess, it's a frustrating thing of that makes sense to me, but then I instantly think of the ideas of like, oh, but then you're going to have players complaining that they never have a season off. They never have a summer off, like, or fully off. They're always going to have major competitions. But then you've got to be flexible in the COVID era. But then are we being I don't know. It's the hard thing about the world we live in right now, that for every solution, it feels like it then creates other problems. And basically, we're just not going to ever have the ideal scenario, at least not right now. This is kind of a depressing way to begin, but I think it was sort of hanging over me as I watched all these games.
I think you're completely wrong there. I mean, look at Alexis Sanchez. He played major tournaments every year for like 6 years. He's still at the very top of his game. He looks amazing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Chile get, I think, a draw. I'm going to talk a little bit more about South American qualifying later on in the week with Felipe Cardenas. You and I are going to talk a little bit about it on today's show, but why don't we start with some games that did happen. Let's go to, say, England-Belgium. A good result for England, and yet simultaneously maybe also not a great result for England.
Yeah, on paper, this looks very good. England beat the number one ranked team in the world. Yes, Belgium, lest we remind you, are the number one ranked team in the FIFA rankings at the moment. It means that England go top of the group in the Nations League, because apparently that is an important objective for England. And, you know, a home win and having only one goal conceded, I believe, in the calendar year of 2020 for this team looks very good. However, if you took a cursory glance at actually looking at the game itself, not so hot. This was not classic England. Let me rescind that. This was classic England.
Yeah.
This was not the England we've gotten used to at, say, the 2018 World Cup.
Yes, I think you're right to say it was sort of classic England, except that there's a great breakdown of this result in The Athletic where they kind of point out that it's classic England, except that they got a result. And England historically, I think you have to go back pretty far to find a time when they were able to beat a top-tier opponent at international level. Like, you have moments here and there, but generally speaking, there haven't been that many. And so this was sort of England being a bit more defensive, a bit more stodgy, if you will, but still at the same time getting a result. So in some ways, I understand. It feels like one of those games like Gareth Southgate is having in which he's really happy with the result, but then also sort of confused by the reaction from some fans, some members of the media who didn't enjoy the way England played, who didn't think it was a particularly aesthetically pleasing game. I think that sort of juxtaposition makes a little bit more sense when you look at what England were trying to do and how it wasn't necessarily the prettiest of things.
I think I've seen this game referred to as a Steve Bruce win, which is very gritty and, you know, relying on set pieces, which is fair enough. It got the job done. Here's a quote for you, Taylor, from Gareth Southgate. "We can be a free-flowing, free-scoring team, but against the very best, the detail of how you defend as a team has got to be absolutely bang on. In the second half, we got that right. In the first half, we struggled." So he's kind of justifying the overly defensive layout of this team and just rightly saying that the team did improve in the second half. And I'm fine for you to say that against the very best teams, i.e. the number one team in the FIFA rankings, you could shut up shop a little bit and maybe sit back a little bit. But this exact issue came up in the other Nations League games against Denmark, against Iceland, which were also not very convincing. And can I make my major statement of the podcast so far, Taylor? I'm going to say that England are Germany.
Interesting. So you have won the World Cup and you're looking like a cohesive team with lots of talented players?
Yeah, we make wonderful automobiles. No, we did avoid England becoming Germany around 1945. I mean this more in the soccer sense, in the basically the same formations, the same under-fire managers, the same dial play, the same repetition of player positions. So look at England, starting three right-backs, only having one left-footed player on the field, not an outfield player, and doing that 3-4-3 or 3-4-2-1, I suppose you could call it, but not really using the wing-backs as wing-backs and having players not really in their most comfortable natural positions. Then you go over to Germany, same formation, basically a 3-4-3, 3-4-2-1, and basically five centre-backs, and not using wing-backs as you should do, and having a manager under fire, and having sort of a consensus among the fans, Taylor, that both teams won this weekend, but maybe a loss would have been better for the long-term future of those teams because it might have caused some more action. Both managers sort of arguably not up to the post, which is a very tough thing to say about Yogi Löw having achieved what he's achieved, but there's a sense which we can get to when we talk about that game later that he might be a little past it. But going back to England, I think that, you know, the idea of playing sort of defensive dour soccer and using a formation which has the potential to be used in a sprightly attacking way, but not doing so was the issue.
So to clarify, because I think I misunderstood you in the beginning there, when you're saying England are, did you say the new Germany or just England are Germany?
They are Germany. One and the
same. There we are. Okay, that was my mistake then. I apologize. So you're basically saying the criticisms that you could levy on one, you could maybe extend to the other right now?
Richtig, yeah.
Yeah. I think the difference for me is that England aren't Germany. we're doing a lot of innovative podcasting here. But just that, like, England haven't had the kind of success that Germany have had. Yes, the 2018 World Cup does not go well for Germany. It goes better for England. But I think historically, obviously, the number of World Cups won would indicate that. I think Germany, there is more reason in my mind to be frustrated with this current team, especially if you are German. Whereas with England, I do think this is still Southgate experimenting and trying to adapt. And when we talk about, like, evolution of teams, I think there's always this idea that they're evolving to this next level of being this really exciting, creative team. And I don't necessarily think that's always true. I think especially in the international game, you can be evolving towards an ideal tournament team. Jonathan Liu, writing for The Guardian, made this point really well, that this felt like a team that weren't there to impress and play this really sophisticated brand of attacking pretty soccer. It was to win a tournament game, and that's why you go back three, you put Harry Winks and Jordan Henderson in front, you play a lot of center backs, as you said, and it feels like a dress rehearsal for playing defensively against a team that you expect to have a lot of the ball and create a lot of chances. And to some extent, that's how this went down. England may be fortunate with the penalty decision to get back into it, but I think that's where Gareth Southgate is probably feeling optimistic that they're able to nullify this aggressive attack from Belgium, the number one ranked team in the world. I think that's probably where he's feeling more optimistic than, say, Yogi Löw in Germany's win over Ukraine.
That's fair enough. And to kind of go on that angle, there's sort of Germany have a reputation of not playing wonderfully in friendlies, if we can call this a friendly. They certainly treated the last Nations League not super important, having been relegated from it. Yikes, even though they're not relegated anymore because they changed it and the Nations League's a bit of a sham. But hey, there we go. That's another conversation. But I think my point is, Taylor, England and Germany being one and the same, if you look at where they are in October 2020, neither of them seem terribly close to doing some damage at Euro 2021. I think Portugal and France seem kind of quite far ahead of them. Is that fair to say?
It is. I would say this, though. Like not to be stick in the mud here, but I think if we're getting good soccer at the next Euros, then yes, they're far off. But if this is a preview of the type of soccer we're going to get, which is you're going to have a lot of players coming off of a rough season, a compact and yet somehow lengthened season because of the number of games. I think you're going to have injuries, you're going to have fatigue. I have a sneaking suspicion that the next Euros are not going to be particularly fun. I think it's going to be a lot of defensive games where, like Belgium in this game, didn't have Eden Hazard. They're missing a few other key players. I think that's a probably good insight into how this team is going to look come the Euros. I think that's going to be the case for a lot of teams. You're going to have fatigue. You're going to have players injured or not, like, or left out of the squad entirely. Again, we'll talk about that when we talk about Germany. But if this is a sign of what's to come of sort of stodgy defensive soccer where you're putting people behind the ball, you're making your opponent beat you, you're looking for the counters, you're looking for individual performers to shine, then maybe England and Germany are positioning themselves well. If we're still going to get some teams playing good soccer, cohesive attacking soccer, which I think we will, then I'm with you that maybe they're a little bit further back than they would like to be. Is that a fair way to kind of break it out?
I think the TLDR of what you just said there was things are going to be great, but not great to watch. But on that note, there's something else that bothered me about this. It's the whole debate about Mason Mount getting in the team over someone like Jack Grealish. And this is something we've seen for decades, for absolute decades in the England team, this reticence to field a maverick player, to field a creative player. It would have been nice to have someone, at least as an option, having Jack Grealish there as a creative outlet. But we've seen over the years that you could probably name only a couple of really creative players who made it with the England side. Paul Gascoigne, I can think of, for example. And you think of players like Glenn Hoddle, Matt Letizia.
How far back you're going, first of all.
Well, yeah, exactly. There is that. But yeah, Matt Letizia, one of the best Premier League players of all time, played a couple of England games. Rodney Marsh, going back even further, extremely talented, only a few England games. These kind of maverick number 10-ish skillful players don't ever get given a chance in this team, which likes to be a bit more conservative in its approach. And I think it's a little disappointing to see that continuing with this game.
Where would you like, so, and maybe it requires an entire formation change, but say we stick with the Southgate 3-4-3/5-2-3, which had Rashford on the left side, Mason Mount on the right, Dominic Calvert-Lewin up top. Where would you like Jack Grealish to get some minutes, to get some opportunities, or do you think it requires Southgate changing things up to get him into that team?
Couldn't it not just be a straight switch for Mount?
I suppose that's what I'm asking. So you think, because I guess that's the confusing thing, right, is if we're talking about like, oh, he's not making time for a young, exciting English attacking player, but we're then putting in Grealish at that, like, instead of Mason Mount. Like, that, I guess that's what I mean, is that I think that attack doesn't necessarily give you as many opportunities to get a lot of those promising youngsters in. So to some extent, it always necessitates leaving out a few because of the defensive approach.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I think nobody's going to be completely happy when these kind of lineups came out. But I just thought I'd like to have seen a more creative outlet. And I know that there's a big love in about Jack Grealish, who is, you know, you can call him a soup du jour mid-table favourite at the moment if you're going to be harsh on him, but I think he could have done a really good job in this team and livened up this game a little bit.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, you may have just made me a believer in the 5 seconds there, because, I mean, like, if we're talking about England being a bit more defensive in their approach against this top-tier opposition, if we do think the Euros are going to be a less aesthetically pleasing tournament, then maybe Aston Villa are a good blueprint for what England should be doing, which is being defensive, looking to smash on the counter. And Jack Grealish does pretty well with Aston Villa, at least of late. So maybe your point is well taken, that if you want to kind of emulate the Aston Villa blueprint, it makes sense to put in a player who does very well for Aston Villa. And I'm guessing we will get to see more of him. England obviously have another game this week. I don't know if we'll see, say, Harry Kane. Jose Mourinho desperate for Harry Kane not to play. So who knows what happens there? But I also think that maybe England fans can take some solace in the idea that for this team, I think Dominic Calvert-Lewin doing similar things to what Harry Kane would be doing and not looking so off the pace. I don't think Dominic Calvert-Lewin had a great game against Belgium. I think there were some chances maybe he could have done a little bit better with. He could have been a little bit better in his holdup, but there are moments like he has a really good flick when England are trying to play out of the back. Belgium overcommit. There's a long ball in. I think he wins a header over two different Belgian defenders and flicks it on for Marcus Rashford to launch a counterattack. I thought he did a really good job in that regard of linking and holding up play and being physical and battling for chances and still doing what he could to create some of his own. But I think that is another thing that maybe England fans can feel somewhat optimistic about, is that there is an option if Harry Kane cannot go. I'm not saying Dominic Calvert-Lewin is at Harry Kane's level, but I was impressed with some of the things I saw. If he had been a little bit sharper, I would have been much more impressed.
I thought he did a perfectly good job, and I think you can definitely make the case that he did a better job than Harry Kane would have for 90 minutes in this instance. And also, I think it's kind of, you're comparing him to Romelu Lukaku on the other side of the field,
a bit unfair.
Who looked really good, didn't he, and just looked really fast at times and quite impressive. And let's give credit to Belgium in this game as well, because they started the first 10 minutes, they didn't really know where they were, and then they slowly got into this game more and more, and I thought they were very impressive. The front three was very impressive. Kevin De Bruyne is outrageous. Mm-hmm. There was that pass in, I think, sort of the 70, 75th minute where he put through, was it Carrasco, I think he put through, who nodded the ball wide?
Yeah.
Not nodded the ball, he sort of tapped the ball wide. Carrasco had two or three really solid chances that could have absolutely buried this game. So if his finishing was better, I think this would have been a very different story on a Monday to be talking about.
And just to jump in really quickly, that would be Yannick Carrasco starting because Eden Hazard cannot. So yeah, you throw a fully fit, ready to go Eden Hazard into that team, I think there's maybe more goals.
Because who can't start?
Eden Hazard.
Who's that?
Oh, you're not familiar with him? He's this guy. He used to be very good, and now I think he still plays somewhere in Spain.
Huh. I'll have to look into that. I'll
I'm not going to lie. You were so genuine there for a moment that I got nervous, that I was like, is he Dutch? Did I get it wrong?
So thanks for that. Pull you out on radio.
I think I've done that like once or twice before in the past, insisted a player played for, I don't know, one country when they played for another one, but here I got it right. Sorry, I interjected though. You were saying more about this Belgium team.
I'd finished on my Belgian team rant, but basically just saying this could have been a very different story because this was an impressive team. You can see why they are highly ranked in Europe, which still feels incredible saying that about a team coached by Roberto Martinez, but here we are.
Agreed. I also think maybe a little bit hard done. There was no VAR in this one. There's a very late offside call on an early goal that was not meant to be. I think replays for Carrasco, I think replays showed he was onside is what I saw. The commentators doing that like, yeah, it's he's offside, I think. I was like, you both know that he is not. But it does not end up mattering because England get that win. Marcus Rashford with the penalty, Mason Mount with the goal in the 64th minute. And it does take, I believe, a decent deflection. Am I remembering that correctly?
Big old deflection on the goal and the penalty, very softly won, I think you could say.
And it feels like tournament football to me, man.
Very much. So Jordan Henderson sort of making the most of some contact from, it was Thomas Meunier, wasn't it? Who after the game, I don't know if you saw the clip, sort of went up to Henderson and was joking and sort of showing him how he went down, which I recommend you look up. And Jordan Henderson seemed to be finding it very hilarious, and maybe it wasn't intended in that fashion. But that's another angle to look at this game. England got two very fortunate goals to win it as well.
Hey, but you know what? You got to take the chances you can. I think Jordan Henderson as well is not a player that – he strikes me as a person who's never going to be that lighthearted after a result. I feel like he's taking that Klopp inspiration to heart. So even if he had gone down easily, I'm sure he wouldn't want to admit it right after the game. But England with the win, they are top of their group in the Nations League, which I'm sure Daryl will be pumped about, even if Ryan is less excited about the Nations League. Are you excited about it at all, or is it just this time round it feels weird?
I think, as I say, I'm on board with it. But like, say when you think of Portugal, who won the last one, I think of them as the European champions. I barely remember that they won the Nations League. I think it's still a bit of a footnote in terms of the whole game, right?
Yes, in that I could not tell you who had won it. That said, that is, I think, the way we began the show. It's just a strange thing because it's been so long. Like, Brazil, I think this is their first international game since November of last year. Like, it's been so long, and yet so many random things and non-random things have happened in that time period that it's tough to keep track of everything. We're going to try to keep track of all the other games that happened. But first, we're going to take a moment to talk about today's sponsors. Let's start with looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Artifact, Ryan Bailey. Artifact sets you up with one of their professional interviewers to capture stories about the important people or things in your life. You can think of it like your favorite podcast, but about whatever you want. So any topic you want, you can set up an artifact to be recorded, and then you're ending up with a professional product that sounds like a This American Life episode.
Does Ira Glass come and do it for you? Is that part of the deal?
It's just George doing his best Ira Glass, I think. No, aww. I think they have different interviewers, maybe Ira Glass one day. But I would like it if they were all sort of doing an Ira Glass impression.
George, I think, could do a very good Ira Glass. And Artifact is a wonderful service. I think it's this very unique situation here where you might look back at photographs and things like that. But these days, why not have a podcast to relay your memories and have a story told professionally by an Ira Glass impersonator? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about my own Artifact, Taylor. I think I might do one about my podcasting and have George sit in while I podcast with you and sort of commentate over it, lightly talking in the background of TSS episodes. What do you think?
I think it could be fun. I like the idea of George sitting in. George asked us some when Daryl and I did the one for the TSS origin story, which you can find at heyartifact.com/TSS. There were some questions in there that I think were designed to provoke, to sort of poke at us a little bit and see what would happen. I don't think we took the bait too much. But yeah, I can envision George sitting in and then being like, now, Ryan, it seemed like you didn't like that transition there. What did you make of that moment? George's trying to instigate is, I guess, what I'm getting at.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's scrap that. I don't want to do that. New idea. I'm going to talk about my parents instead.
Ryan scraps that and comes up with new ideas, if you have an idea of your own, The Athletic currently are running a contest. If you go to heyartifact.com/TSS contest, if it's not up today, it will be up very soon. Basically, they want people to go there and tell Artifact about what they would like to use Artifact for. And then if you do submit one, they're going to do a random drawing at the end. I believe the plan is that the person who wins gets that random drawing will be getting a free Artifact or a very discounted Artifact. URL should be active, heyartifact.com/TSS contest. You can go there, talk about an idea you had or what you think could be a good idea for an artifact to give them some new ideas, some new areas. If you want to schedule one of your own, you can do so at heyartifact.com, and you can use the promo code TSS to get $40 off. That's heyartifact.com, and use the promo code TSS to get $40 off. Thank you very much to Artifact for sponsoring.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode, thank you very much to LinkedIn for sponsoring this episode of the Total Soccer Show. Ryan, I know you have priors with LinkedIn. I have priors with LinkedIn. What do you make of their new services? What do you make of LinkedIn?
What I find, Taylor, is that small businesses have unique needs. And despite the current uncertainty, one thing that remains unchanged is the importance of having the right people on your team. When your business is ready to make that next hire, LinkedIn Jobs can help by matching your role with qualified candidates so that you can find the right person quickly. And I can attest to this, Taylor, as a user of this here service. I think of all the job sites, and I'm a freelance person, I do tend to look around at what opportunities are out there. And LinkedIn Jobs, I really think, is the best because it tailors automatically. When you pull up linkedin.com/jobs, it tailors all of the job offerings to your location and to your experience on your LinkedIn profile. So it's done all of the input work for you, and you can change the location if you want to move somewhere else. I'm a big fan of it, Taylor.
What are the things you're usually – like if you, Ryan, or people who are freelancers are interested in getting into creating soccer content, being involved in the soccer media landscape, what are the things you look for? As you said, you look for like proximity to your residents, I'm assuming. But yep. are you going marketing? Are you going media? Are you – like what are the kind of things you're looking for, the keywords that clue you in? Not to give away all your secrets.
Can include editorial, social media, digital content, video production.
Not
podcasting, because I'm very happy in my podcasting role right now.
Oh, that's
but all
good.
Those kind of things are the ones you can look for.
All right. You can look for those. And when your business is ready to make the next hire, you can find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit LinkedIn.com/TSS. Again, that's LinkedIn.com/TSS to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions do apply, as they are wont to do. But thank you to LinkedIn for sponsoring this episode. Ryan, let's get back to the weekend that was some of the international break. I alluded a lot to Ukraine 1, Germany 2. Should we talk about that one for a moment?
Yeah, sure. So Ukraine played England in Kiev. It was 2-1 on Saturday. I don't know if you saw it. I've mentioned there was a lot of Vuvuzela noise. There were 20,000 fans allowed into this one. This might have been the most attended game, if I'm not mistaken. It feels like it would be. Anyway, this was Germany overtaking Ukraine in Nations League A Group 4, which is the vital info which we all need from this, of course. This is Germany's first ever Nations League win. And this once again makes a mockery of this competition a little bit, because you might remember Germany in the last Nations League were relegated from the top flight, from Group A. Croatia, Iceland and Poland were also relegated, but hey, they all got a do-over because they expanded the League A from 16 teams to 12 teams, thus really giving a wonderful boost to the credibility of this competition and the integrity as well. So Germany back in it, getting their first win in this competition. Also, one other note I'll say off the top. I'd forgotten that Andriy Shevchenko was Ukraine's coach, and it was delightful to see him.
See, that's the type of thing that like I do love about the international break, and I think was even more on display here because of the gap we've had with some of these teams that like, oh, right, Shevchenko's around. That's exciting. That's a fun thing to see. I thought this game was really interesting because I watched it not knowing the sort of background of Germany and the current situation of Germany, and it felt like a very standard road international, that Germany playing at Ukraine in the COVID times, it's not the most impressive result. They're not tearing the doors off or anything like that, but it's kind of workmanlike. They get the result. It's 2-1, and yeah, it's all fine. I mean, like, and even this is how far removed I was, that I was like, I mean, and they're doing this without Thomas Müller. I'm assuming that's due to fatigue, and then kind of remembering after the fact with some of the criticisms that came in that, no, he has just been removed from the squad. Yogi Löw no longer calling him, no longer calling Boateng or Mats Hummels after 2018. Suddenly, this result, which looked like, yeah, okay, they got a result, good stuff for Germany, you look at it in that context and in the context of former national players like Schweinsteiger making some comments, and suddenly it's a weird thing where they're still being Germany, you're still seeing them get results here and there, but there is this idea that Yogi Löw has maybe gotten a little bit long in the tooth.
Yeah, I think there is this... We know what Germany are like. We know that, you know, they've won a World Cup without basically having a striker, and... Mm-hmm. We know that they're not all out attacking, and they do things quite sensibly. But there's similar issues here, as I mentioned, to with England, like playing five centre backs in your team, basically with your back five, and not making the most of. I mean, Germany have quite a lot of attacking talent. Why not do a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1 and try and go for it a little bit more in this and make more of that really good Kimmich Kroos double pivot in the middle? And you know, Timo Werner and Kai Havertz only came on in the last 10 minutes of this game, and otherwise you've got Serge Gnabry up front on his own, who's a perfectly capable player, but I would suggest maybe not the ideal candidate for that role. And there is, as you say, a lot of criticism coming out of Germany of Yogi Löw, and it's building a little bit with, as you alluded to, Bastian Schweinsteiger criticising Yogi Löw. He said, you can no longer identify 100% with the national team, and that's sad. So he's you know, framing this as an issue of identity, that his team is almost losing its identity. And Yogi Löw, maybe his time has come. I mean, it sounds like sacrilege to say it after everything he's achieved, as I said earlier in the show, but I don't know, Taylor. What do you think? Do you think that they could do a little fresh lick of paint? Maybe certainly a manager with a slightly more edgy haircut than Jurgen Klopp's got.
Yeah. The turtleneck and helmet hair look like, I think before we started recording, I said it reminded me of Anton Chigurh if he wore a turtleneck. It looks good when you're like sort of young and vibrant and you're the young upstart and it's like, oh, everyone's wearing the same thing. You have a uniform. It's Steve Jobs. You don't want to have to think about what you're wearing. Yeah. You just want to think about the results on the pitch. Yes, there is a moment where it's like, oh, we're still? Still doing that? Like, suddenly it does look a little bit outdated. That's more of a wardrobe selection issue.
So, to me, it looks like, Taylor, if the movie Anchorman had a librarian in it, that would be him. He'd be playing it.
And it would have to be a German librarian. That is the way they would go. So, yes, I think that's a great shout. The other part of Schweinsteiger's quote that I thought was also pretty revealing, I would have liked to see one more player in midfield or up front. I would have played with four at the back instead of five. That would be good for the game. Yeah, and then the results aren't as they should be. The attractiveness is lacking a bit. I think there's been a lot of the idea that Hansi Flick was a Yogi Löw assistant, that now he's with Bayern Munich. There used to be the narrative that like maybe Yogi Löw was Jurgen Klinsmann's genius in 2006. I like that now it's Hansi Flick was Yogi Löw's genius. And there's been much speculation that maybe they should just play the same way as Bayern Munich. I think the thing there would be, you said Serge Gnabry started up front for Germany in this game. They don't have Robert Lewandowski. He plays for Poland. I don't think that you can do what Bayern Munich do and not have Robert Lewandowski in there. They certainly don't have Thomas Müller for reasons I already mentioned. So I think that that's sort of just an oversimplification. Not saying that you did that, Ryan, but some of the analysis has been like, well, you have the best club team in the world. Just do what they do. Yeah. But I think that that fundamentally does not work for Germany. So I think this is Yogi Löw trying to figure it out. The analogy that I think fits better in my mind is Lucien Favre at Borussia Dortmund. That they can consistently do well, they can blow some teams out of the water, they can have big results against big opposition, and yet there are still just those moments of like, but this doesn't feel like as good as it could be. This doesn't seem as though they're playing at that next level that they need to be. Maybe it is time for a change just to get this team functioning at 100% capacity as opposed to 80% capacity. So that's maybe the argument for why there should be some change, coupled with what I think they still aren't getting particularly good results. Prior to this result, three straight draws against Spain, Turkey, and Switzerland. The Turkey result, they concede goals in the dying moments. So there is that kind of idea that maybe we need somebody to come in with fresh ideas, with a fresh look for the team, reintegrate some players that have been frozen out. All that to say, I don't think it's going to happen because I don't think that they're going to want to get rid of him before the Euros. And I think even if the Euros go poorly, I don't know if you, Germany, can sort of change things on the fly with the World Cup following that next summer. I honestly think that even if things don't really drastically improve for Germany, we're going to see Yogi Löw at the 2022 World Cup.
Yeah, and it does seem like, I mean, they could have pulled the trigger after the last World Cup, couldn't they? There was a Toni Kroos free kick goal away from being a pretty big disaster, if my memory serves me correct, on Germany's campaign there. But we look at this game, Taylor, and let's be fair to Germany, they'd have lots of chances. Ukraine's goalkeeper made a lot of great saves in this game, and I believe he's maybe their fourth choice, because if you were following the narrative in their midweek game, they had to include their 45-year-old retired goalkeeping coach in the squad because they lost their other three first-choice keepers testing positive for COVID. So stepping up in a big time was Ukraine's goalkeeper. But
Bouchan. He also drops the ball onto the head of Goretzka for the winning goal, what proved to be the winning goal. So even with a strong performance.
He didn't have a perfect one because he did very much cause that goal and had a big boo-boo, but otherwise was pretty good, I would say. But this is a Ukraine side who got absolutely tanked 7-1 by France. This is basically a Ukraine B team, and Germany are just effectively scraping by them. And that, by any measures of the German national team, is not good enough.
Yeah, I understand that point as well. I kind of forgot that they got tonked as badly as they did. I would say that one, maybe not that big of a difference, but that is them playing away to France. It is still, I believe, roughly the exact same shape of a kind of a defensive 4-1-4-1. And so with those like outliers put into place, I think that you're not wrong that a France team that comes out in a back four with Olivier Giroud and Anthony Martial and kind of go at Ukraine and try to be attacking and proactive get seven goals. So maybe we can still look to France to play some exciting soccer, though their results this weekend maybe not necessarily indicating that. But so, yeah, I think if you do sort of look at those two results, maybe that does strengthen the argument that Yogi Löw needs to freshen things up or try some new things, because it worked for France. It didn't really work so well for Germany.
Freshen things up, try some new things, and we're not just talking about the haircut, Yogi.
No, we're not. Although, we can talk about that, too. Although you definitely should do that, yes. But so what do you think, Ryan? Would you like to, if you were suddenly the head of the German FA, would you be like aggressively investigating other coaching options?
If I was the head of the German FA, and God willing I will be one day, Taylor, then probably I would. I think you're right in saying that now's not the time, because you have to give Jürgen Löw this process through to at least the Euros, which, you know, without COVID, maybe he would have been taking a walk by now. yeah. So I think the decision has to be made next summer now, because it would be too much of a mess to change it now. They're not Spain. They're not changing their coach 2 days before a tournament or anything like that. They're too organized for that.
All right. So we'll see what happens there. Let's stick with France, though, for a moment, because France do destroy Ukraine 7-1 in that friendly. That was, I guess last week, October 7th. Dates are all meaningless. Time is all meaningless. What did you make of their game against Portugal?
This was, I believe, the most even game of all time. This was the World Cup champions against the European champions. You know, the billing for this one's pretty good. Did you see the stats?
They're all like, what, the exact same?
10 shots each, 3 shots on targets each. Possession, 49-51 in Portugal's favour. Passes, 572 to 580, Portugal's favour. Pass accuracy, 86 to 88 in Portugal's favour. So Portugal edging this one on the stats by the narrowest of margins. I don't know. What did you think of this game, Taylor? It was. I thought Portugal looked very good. I thought they looked annoyingly as if they're probably going to win Euro 2020. Good. I think that was my main takeaway from this game.
What makes you feel that way? Because given what we've already said about what the Euros could be and how it tends to be teams that, I mean, you look at Portugal's last Euro championship and it is a team, I would say, not necessarily built around the superstars. Worth remembering Cristiano Ronaldo is not like on the field when the final whistle goes when they win the title there. So I take your point, but did you see that level of grit and that level of fight in this Portugal team?
Hang on. Ronaldo wasn't on the field, but he was coaching them. He did assume roles of the head coach when he got injured, so let's not forget that.
Poor Fernando Santos.
We saw that previous Portugal team and Portugal teams were all sort of grinding out wins, almost Steve Bruce style, as we've mentioned previously here. But it just seems that they've added a lot more flair to this team as well, and they're very solid. They're very well organized. I could just see them just grinding through a tournament. They're a good tournament team, aren't they?
They are. There's still Pepe there. Don't worry, folks. Pepe will never not be there.
Pepe is 37 years old.
He sure is.
And I think he's captaining Porto now. It's incredible stuff. Pepe is still looking as athletic as ever. And if we're going to talk about the centre-backs, Ruben Dias, very encouraging performance for Man City as well, because he looked like he was in control.
Absolutely, and I think that back line, the midfield, the front line, even Rui Patricio in goal, I think it is a Portugal team that I would say it is a little bit different than the last Euros team, because to me they're better like across the board. Yes, Ronaldo's older. Yes, Pepe is older. But João Félix starts this game, is, if not starting to find form, is still just an incredibly promising player that has already gotten that big move. We'll see what happens there. But Bernardo Silva playing on the right side with Cristiano Ronaldo on the left. William Carvalho still there. Danilo Pereira in the middle. Bruno Fernandes, lest we forget, a part of this Portugal team as well.
Yeah.
Definitely not Brazil. So I think, to some extent, I look at this result as like the two teams that I would not be surprised meeting in the final, and then we see how that final could go with some very, very good attacking teams, but very good defenders looking to balance each other out, but not looking to overcommit. In some ways, I thought this was a good example of what we'll get in the maybe semifinals of the upcoming Euros.
And do you notice how we're framing this all in terms of the Euros and not the Nations League?
Yeah.
We're not talking about the Nations League final, which Portugal got to last time.
This is true.
Thus, further ramming home how unimportant this tournament really is.
I mean, Daryl has always been the one on the show who was much more excited about the Nations League. I came around a bit. This time around, with the season as it is and the way it's going to play out, it feels more of a distraction than an exciting new sort of adjustment to friendlies, because the arguments I've seen as to why these games still went ahead is that, well, if they'd been friendlies, maybe they wouldn't have, even though they played friendlies in September and October, but whatever. Like, if it was friendlies, that would be one thing, but it's Nations League games, so we've got to get these in their official competitions. They matter. Except that the weird thing about the Nations League in the first place was to remove meaningless friendlies. So to some extent, it's like, well, we have to play these because we said we have to play these is essentially the argument in my mind.
That I think you've got it in a nutshell there, yeah, definitely. And maybe some out-of-the-box non-Yogi Löw haircut thinking could have changed that situation, but here we are. And to give a note on France as well, I thought, you know, this was an impressive performance from them as well. They defended very well. I enjoyed watching Benjamin Pavard charging up and down. Mbappe and Griezmann forced a couple of really good saves, but I'll say Mbappe particularly was controlled by Diaz very well in this game as well. So this was pretty even affair, as the stats can attest to, and just, as I say, a further showing that this Portugal team can go toe-to-toe with anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, so I it made me, despite it being a goalless draw, it still made me very excited to see more from both of these teams, which we will, because we've got more Nations League this week. I think France have Croatia. I think Portugal, I think it was Sweden. I forget the groups, which again is sort of a condemnation of the Nations League,
Sweden,
or just me, you know, my lack of paying attention.
You're just being very rude about the Swedes. It is Sweden. Don't forget them.
I never would. I never could. Let's talk one more game for a moment. Ryan, you had Poland-Italy in the show notes, but I'm wondering if you have more than maybe 1 minute of content to say.
So this sentence is, this game appears to have been a waste of everyone's time. Was that a minute? Did I get it?
So what do you mean I didn't see this game? What did you not enjoy about this one?
Full disclosure, I only watched the extended highlights of this one. It just seemed like there was a lot of complaints from Roberto Mancini about a bad pitch that this was being played on, a bad field. It seemed like Italy struggled to create chances a lot in this game, and we only get so many hours in our wonderful weekends in this lifetime, Taylor. And this was 90 minutes that maybe wasn't best spent for those who attended.
From what I heard of the pitch conditions, it reminded me my high school team would not cut the grass for the week before we played a team that was much better than us, because it would always slow them down. And then we could also, like, one of the things we learned is the grass would hold up, so we could just punt the ball long and they would think it was going out of bounds, but then it would slow up and stay in, so we could use that to our advantage. Maybe that's what Poland were doing as well. I hope they went for inner city high school tactics.
I can remember that's not just a high school tactic, because I remember, I believe it was the opening day of the 96-97 season, Wimbledon, my team, we hosted Liverpool. And it was like one of those sunny August days, first day of the season, everyone's very excited. But when we got to the stadium and we saw the players warming up, we noticed that the grass looked really long. Like, literally, it was like almost coming up to like half of where the ball was when it was being passed. And Liverpool obviously at this very, at the time, they passed the ball along the floor a lot, which wasn't necessarily what everybody did in the mid-90s. And Wimbledon were very much a get the ball in the air and get it directly to the front line kind of team. And we won that game 1-0, and it was pretty obvious that the field had something to do with that.
Hey, man, you got to be practical. It's all about practicality when it comes to getting those results. That's what tournament football has taught us. That's what the Nations League has taught us? Question mark. We'll talk more Nations League in a second. We'll talk a little bit of Common Bowl as well. But first, let's talk about today's sponsor.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
We've got a new one, Ryan Bailey. It's Credible.com. Credible.com is an online marketplace that allows borrowers with student loan debt to see refinancing rates across a variety of lenders. Credible would like people with student loan debt to come check out student loan refinancing rates, find a rate and a lender that works for them, and ultimately refinance their student loans.
Essentially, Tay-Tay, if you've got a student loan debt, you could benefit from Credible. There are lots of benefits to refinancing.
What are those benefits, Ryan? Tell me those benefits.
I shall outlay them for you right now. Thank you for asking. With a lower rate, you could save on interest or lower your monthly payment, which means more money in your pocket. You can get debt-free faster. You can consolidate all your student loan bills into one place. That gives you Serious peace of mind. Credible customers have given awesome reviews about how much their financial lives have been after refinancing.
Some benefits of using Credible to refinance your student loans are that you see actual pre-qualified rates from multiple lenders, whereas with some online marketplaces, you'll get ranges of rates or ballpark estimates, and it only takes a couple of minutes to check rates, and it does not impact your credit. Does not impact your credit. Emphasizing that. They're so confident they have the best rates that they'll give you a $200, if you close a loan with a better rate elsewhere. They will also never sell your data, and you won't receive spam or phone calls from dozens of lenders.
Well, how do we do this, Taylor? How do we get involved in this? I'm going to tell you right now.
Please
do. You've got to visit credible.com/TSS. That's credible.com/TSS. Almost like a chant there. And then you can refinance your student loan via Credible. And once again, as Taylor said, they'll give you a $200 gift card. Fill in a few pieces of info to check what rates you are eligible for. Again, that's credible.com/TSS. Refinancing your student loans and starting to save couldn't be easier. Credible.com/TSS, baby.
Message from Credible Operations, Inc. Not available in all states. Terms and conditions apply. Visit credible.com/TSS for details. Thank you to Credible for sponsoring today's episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Thank you to Roman for sponsoring today's episode. Talking about erectile dysfunction is not easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Austin Powers, like, inspired a whole generation of people to explain away their issues.
Does anybody ever say, I lost my mojo, baby? Like, would not think of Austin Powers.
I don't think so. I feel like you would have to put the English accent on it, or at least, you know, like, put on some glasses or snarl your teeth a little bit. But the key point there would be that we kind of explain it away, people explain it away, not realizing that it's a more common issue. It's just a slightly awkward one to talk about, which is why it's sometimes awkward to do these ad reads. But with Roman, it's easy to talk about it with a real healthcare professional who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet.
With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your own home.
Privacy.
A healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping.
So go to GetRoman.com/TSS today. That's TSS, and then you should do it today. If approved, you'll get $15 off your first order of erectile dysfunction treatment. That's GetRoman.com/TSS. GetRoman.com/TSS. Thank you very much to Roman for sponsoring today's episode of The Total Soccer Show. Ryan Bailey, let's stay with the UEFA Nations League for a moment. Shall we talk about Spain?
Sure.
All right. Spain, but not Switzerland is, I guess, what I'm getting at. Spain with a 1-0 win over Switzerland. Another result similar to Germany that was, like, good on paper, a good result in a challenging time, but it doesn't necessarily inspire. Is that a fair way to phrase this one?
Yeah, I wouldn't say this is a terribly inspiring game. This one, whenever Spain plays Switzerland, it always reminds me of that first game of the 2010 World Cup when Switzerland beat Spain 1-0.
Oh,
we were,
yeah,
like, writing off Spain. And then they did something rather special in that tournament, it turns out. So this wasn't quite the same story in this one, the score going the other way. What else are we going to say about this game? I liked seeing Ansu Fati getting a start, and also Adama Traore got on the field for this one as well. Although not, as ESPN FC noted, at the same time, so on the same flank. So that would have been interesting maybe to see them both play together. But I don't know. Not a super exciting game this one either.
I thought you were pumped about Sergio Ramos, man.
So, Graham?
I thought you were pumped about Sergio Ramos.
Well, I'm always pumped about Sergio Ramos, obviously. There was one moment which kind of highlighted how brilliant Sergio Ramos is. How would you describe that tackle, Taylor? Is it a backstop tackle, a reverse heel tackle?
I feel like I always call it the scorpion tackle, which is incorrect because the scorpion one is more of that scorpion kick. But it's whenever you, like, you have your plant foot and you use... Like, so in this case, I think it's what he has, like, his left foot facing the player, and then he uses his right foot to reach around the left foot to block the ball coming in. It's a really good, like, defensive approach, like, and people will use it, I think, as a way to sort of, like, bait a player into cutting back, and then you're there for it, except that this wasn't even that. It really was just Sergio Ramos, I think. It wasn't a deliberate thing just in the moment. It was like, oh, he's going to do that. This is the only way I can defend it, so I'm going to throw a leg at it. And it absolutely works because he's Sergio Ramos.
It did look like he'd taken a step too far and the player had cut in and turned in. Maybe it was a deliberate move to do that, but he did stick out his leg like it was sort of a yoga pose. Not only did he completely cleanly win the ball, but the leg extension also completely took out the player as well. It was so functional. It was wonderful to see. Ramos actually has tweeted it. He's tweeted it with the line, access denied.
Yes.
So I encourage you to look at Sergio Ramos's Twitter feed to see the most handsome man in the world do the most handsome tackle in the world.
I love it. I would say we forgot that Andrei Shevchenko is the manager of Ukraine. I would say for people who don't remember, Luis Enrique, formerly of Barcelona, is the manager of Spain. And I think you could sort of see his influence in the way this game played out, because it's Spain counter-pressing, pressing high up the field, forcing Sommer, the Switzerland goalkeeper, into a bad pass, / Granit Xhaka loses his footing. Spain capitalized very, very, very quickly. Mikel Moreno picks up the ball, plays it into Mikel Oyarzabal, who, it's a really good finish, just turns and I believe one time finishes it across his body into the far corner.
Yeah.
And that's in the 14th minute, and kind of from that point on, you could see that Spain, like, all right, now you have to come beat us, and we're not going to make that easy. So I felt like Spain were decently good in possession. They don't, in my mind, create that many more, like, clear-cut chances. It's not the type of game that should have ended 4-0 but was only 1-0. But I think for Spain, it was a sort of comprehensive victory, if not necessarily the most inspiring. And then you have, like, the other pieces being added, as you said, Ansu Fati, but then Adama Traore comes in, looks like Adama Traore and does Adama Traore things and has an instant impact in creating a little bit of a spark. So I think there are also reasons for optimism if you are a fan of Spain.
Yeah, there are reasons for optimism, but also I'd say maybe let's counter that with some reason for pessimism. As you say, there was some good counter-pressing to start with, but they did kind of sit back on it for a lot of the game. A lot of the sort of things we've criticised Spain for recently, you know, having lots of possession, but just doing lots of fairly meaningless sideways passes, not trying to pick out those players going forward, not enough sort of players who would take on other players 1v1, which is maybe where Fati and Traore are exciting additions. But, you know, it just seems like there was a lot of uninspiring passages of play. Let me put it like that. Not super positive play from Spain, but it was functional because it got the job done. And one other interesting observation, I'd say, Taylor, is the lack of Real Madrid / Barcelona players who currently make up this Spain team. So we had, what, Busquets, Ramos, Fati, and Sergio Roberto?
Mm-hmm.
That, as a percentage of players coming from the two best teams in Spain, is quite low, I would argue, from recent years.
What was the number again?
So it would be Busquets, Ramos, Fati, and Sergio Roberto. So starting, what was it, two of them?
Yeah. Wow. That's a sign of the times, for sure. Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about inspiring football. For, like you said, this wasn't so inspiring from Spain. What does that look like to you? Is it a lot of the ball? Is it a lot of chances? Is it a lot of goals? Is it individual performances? Like, what makes a performance at this sort of competition inspiring to you?
To me, it's less making the passes not be less sideways and backwards, and mm-hmm. making a bit more doing more with the possession, being more penetrative with the possession.
That makes sense.
I think
yeah.
what defines it for me. Maybe that's me being a bit of a Luddite and not understanding the Spanish art project here.
Here's the thing, though, man. Because how much more do you have to say about this game, by the way?
Very little.
All right, because it's a good transition, one that I did not see coming, but works really well, to Norway 4, Romania 0. Ooh. Yes, it's Norway. Yes, it's Romania. It is not Spain playing a good Switzerland team. But it is a lot of vertical passing from Norway that I saw, and I take your point that in these types of games, you need that player who will play those passes and take some risks and sort of make his teammates start to play that way too and change the way the game is being played, change the momentum, the pace of the game a little bit. I saw that a lot in Norway taking apart Romania, who, again, not the strongest of opponents, but it's a hat trick for Erling Haaland. Now has 6 goals in 3 games in the Nations League, so he's doing just fine. But the first goal especially, for people who have not seen it, felt like a view into the future of Real Madrid, because it's Martin Odegaard getting the ball at midfield, splitting, I want to say 4, maybe 5 Romanian defenders, playing it perfectly into the path of Haaland, who takes a touch, finishes well, finishes very cleverly. He has a rifled finish at the end. He has a tap in midway through off of another sort of very unselfish pass from Martin Odegaard. But it was a lot of Norway punishing Romania and being pretty aggressive in their passing and taking big chances. So I think that is really a good example of what you're talking about, of a team that are sort of trying to make things happen, are playing a bit more inspiring football and getting a big result. It made me excited to see what Norway do, both in the Nations League, but more specifically in the Euros to come.
Yeah, definitely. I've always had a soft spot for Norway for various reasons. But if you look back in Norway's history, they are traditionally a very direct team. When they were under, say, Egil Olsen in the 90s, it was always, this is like the Christmas tree formation, always playing the long ball, always getting it forward to the big front man. Erling Haaland would have fitted that system very well indeed. So that sort of continued with them here. And as you say, a pretty good performance from Erling Haaland, getting a few assists with Martin Odegaard as well. That's a nice, neat little combo. Yeah. And I didn't really frame it as a future of Real Madrid situation, but you are bang on there.
Right? It just feels like if they continue to perform the way they were, I would not be surprised if that continues to turn Real Madrid's head a little bit of like, okay, we got Odegaard in there. He's the number 10. He was wearing the number 10 shirt on the day. But I should also say, like, not to just give credit to those two players, the big names. Alexander Sørloth gets a goal, plays very well. Sander Berge starting in the middle for Norway. I never know quite how to pronounce his name, the central defender, but I do my best. There is a lot of talent in that Norway team aside from just those top two performers. Because we do often get those teams that have one or two huge players, Poland looking in your direction with Lewandowski, but don't have the pieces necessary to help them perform more consistently. That's with Poland being one of the top seeded teams, I think, at the 2018 World Cup. But I think you get what I mean. With Norway, I think they've gotten more pieces and more pieces coming through that, I'm pretty excited to see where they go. I'm assuming that we'll get some promotion from them, but who knows? Who knows what will happen, but we'll be back to talk about that if and when it does occur. Let's spend our final little bit of time together, Ryan, on this day, talking about Conmebol Bowl.
That would be my delight. I suppose
Conmebol?
We should look
at I never quite know how to pronounce that one.
Conmebol. So is it
Conmebol? Yeah. All right. Should we talk Argentina? Should we talk Brazil? Where should we start?
Dealer's choice, sir.
Let's go the big results. Brazil 5, Bolivia 0. Although Argentina-Ecuador, 1-0 win for Argentina, also a good result. But Brazil, oh boy, I felt like this was a direct parallel to Neymar playing against bad teams in Ligue 1 with PSG and Neymar playing a bad team in Conmebol with Brazil, because he had some fun in this one. Brazil felt like had a lot of fun in this one. And again, this was another sort of instance of a lot of established names, some names that I was like, oh, right, yeah, that person's Brazilian. And then some names I had never heard of, but all coming together to destroy their regional opponent 5-0.
Yeah, and on the, that person is that nationality, by the way, Joshua King coming on for Norway. That one always gets me.
But right?
Getting back to Brazil and this 5-0 win, yeah, lots of very familiar names on here mixed with some less familiar for us Western soccer viewers, but a pretty enjoyable game, particularly from Neymar's perspective. As you say, didn't get on the score sheet, but got a couple of assists. Some really, really good interplay between him and both Coutinho and Firmino as well. Mm-hmm. I think the third goal, the Firmino goal, was a delightful little pass through from Neymar to make that one happen. So that was it just looked like they were having a really good time out there in this one.
And then I would say the emergence of Aston Villa again, Ryan Bailey. We're seeing Villa just have impacts all over the place because Douglas Luiz involved in this game, I think I'm correct in saying, gets an assist or at the very least is heavily involved in the build up to one of the goals. But playing passes from deeper, winning tackles, being sort of steel in that midfield for Brazil alongside Casemiro, Coutinho looking, again, revitalized, looking happy to be playing with Brazil. Everton, not playing for Everton, but playing for Brazil and doing lots of stepovers in the corner. But again, not stepovers that were needless. It was just sort of a comprehensive performance from Brazil. You could see Chichi celebrating every single one emphatically. It was just a nice reminder that Brazil are always fun.
It's always fun when you've got a player called Everton and another one called Weverton as well. I find that very fun. The goalkeeper, interestingly, keeping Edison on the bench for this one for the entirety.
I did not think of that. Wow, that's big time. Who is, forgive me, Villa fans, who is the Scottish midfielder who plays for Villa and started for Scotland as they got their result?
McGinn?
Yes, John McGinn. I'm just saying, England need to follow suit because Scotland play of a key performer for Villa, they get a result. Brazil do the same, they get a result. I guess England still got the result, but maybe that's where the Jack Grealish comes back in. Put a Villa player in and you win. That's what we've learned this past weekend.
Just put a Villa player in it. That's the
Argentina
way you do it.
Did not play a Villa player, but they still won. This is one of those where it seemed a little bit to me like maybe they're a beneficiary of their not being fans in the stadium. Because this did not feel, again, like a very impressive game. It wasn't the most fun to watch. I think part of that was the way Ecuador chose to approach it, which was being very, very physical and knocking Argentina around. But I did wonder, it being 1-0, if we would have gotten some boos, if there would have been less happiness about this result if it had been a full stadium as opposed to an empty one.
I think that's a fairly certain likelihood, yes. I would say so, yeah. But getting a 1-0 win here from the penalty spot as well. Who else but Lionel Messi stepping up for this one? Was it a 4-3-3 they were playing here, Taylor? I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was something approximating that. It's always tough with that like front three of like, is it a 4-3-1-2? Is it a 4-3-2-1? But yes, roughly it was that shape, yeah.
Well, I think that worked. It seemed to work out pretty well from the extended highlights I watched. This is another one, I must confess, I didn't watch the full match. But another observation, Ecuador's kits are lovely. Those blue shoulders. Oh,
yeah.
Serve me up some of that. And if we're going to talk
kits
about
kits,
by the way, I'll go back to Portugal. What can we have a very brief discussion about those Portugal kits, the white with the green and red stripes, which are only on the front? I couldn't decide whether it was really bad, like Christmas wrapping paper, or I really liked it.
What did you stay divided or did you come away with an answer?
I'm still divided. I'm still there's a Portugal kit dichotomy running through me this instant.
I don't hate it, although you know we know horizontal stripes make you look a little bit wider, and for international footballers who want to look svelte at all times, maybe that will be a thing that holds them back. But no, I think I like the accents. I like throwing in the random, like the green in there with Portugal. I know that is like one of their usual colors, but the dominant white with like lines of green and lines of red. I'm into it. I'm less into, as long as we're going with the kits, Germany's, just because to me it routinely looks like France's historic one, like the white with the lines. It just looked a little bit French to me, and there were moments when I was like, oh, France. Oh wait, no, this is Germany. This is not France. I'm confused again. That might just be me being
silly. World War II joke, but I'll leave it out this time.
I would say Ecuador's kits were maybe inspiring. They're defending less so. I just wanted to call out Pervez Estupiñán, I think is how you pronounce that one. Estupiñán. He was the one who conceded the penalty that led to the penalty for Luis Suarez. Nope, Leo Messi. Lucas Ocampos taken out there. There is one angle in which it looks like Estupiñán gets the ball and not the man, but every other one, he just clearly takes out Lucas Ocampos, like Cobra Kai style, like sweeps his legs. And I just love that the entire Ecuador team seems so, like, chagrined by this one. I don't know if that was them just sort of being revved up for the moment, and maybe that, again, is part of what you have to be when you're playing a physical game like that, but it was just, I draw attention to that just because it was so silly to me to see everybody so up in arms about a moment that was so clearly a penalty. So that was one of the moments that stood out to me in an otherwise uneventful game.
They're quite a physical team, aren't they, Ecuador?
Yeah. And especially when playing at home, which Uruguay will find out, there are comable games this Tuesday. Ecuador hosting Uruguay, Chile hosting Colombia. Chile not off to the strongest start in a draw with, I believe, Peru. So they will obviously want to get the result there. Ecuador are always difficult at altitude at home for Uruguay. So I think we'll see a physical at altitude team for Ecuador. How Uruguay respond to that will be fascinating. But that will be for games tomorrow and later on of the week. For now, Ryan, any other games that you wanted to talk about from this past weekend?
I am contented. We've had a wonderful chat about the weekend, the international break, which I once again will reaffirm I love.
All right, well, I will leave you on that happy note. But Ryan Bailey, thank you for taking all the time to talk all of the games today.
Always a pleasure, never a chore.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.